Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting on NABAZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NABAZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Mary Ann graciously has accepted the invitation. She has spoken at meetings I've been involved with more than once. Always get a lot out of it. And I'm grateful for you, Mary.
Thanks, Tim. Hey, everybody. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here tonight. Thank you, Tim, for asking me to do this meeting tonight. It's always good to do your story because it opens up a lot that you can look at and remember, you know, maybe some things you need to do some more inventory on, maybe some things that, you know, need to be, you know, still things I have to think about and work on. So I'm very glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date, I picked up a white chip at the early morning study group on January 17, 2004, but I really stopped drinking in 1976, in September of 1976, and as I go along with my story, I think you'll see how I qualify for this program. I think you'll understand a whole lot in a very short time. To give you a little background, my mother, was 100% Italian. Her father came over on the boat, came in at Ellis Island. She comes from a family of 10 children and huge Catholic background, and a whole lot of alcoholism was going on in that part of the family as well. And she had aunts and uncles all over the place, and they had settled in Pennsylvania, New York. And my father, he was part American Indian and also German. And he only had an eighth grade education. He came from an extremely abusive household. His father was an alcoholic, and he beat my father sometimes on a daily basis. He beat him so bad at times that one time he shut his kidneys down. But when my father and mother met, my grandparents were very much against this marriage. But they married anyway outside of the Catholic Church, and I was their fourth child. I was the fourth of four children. When I was born, my father had become very, very ill. He was in a sanitarium. He had tuberculosis, and in those days, tuberculosis was like COVID. And nobody wanted to be around us. Nobody, even family members, wouldn't come and help us out. They wouldn't come to the house. Here my mother was. She'd never worked before, and she had four children. And no one to really help her. And my siblings were left. She tried to go out and get jobs, and my siblings were left to take care of me. When my father finally came home, I was 18 months old. And that was such a moment for me. I can remember the pattern on the furniture. I can remember the smell. I can remember everything. He was this huge, great big piece of fear for me. And because of his low self-esteem and his alcoholism and his not being able to do a whole lot with his life, he was very upset with me about that. And the two of us ended up in this war basically for the rest of our lives. We never got along. We never really, there was never much between us. And he didn't care. My father was not happy where he was, and he was not happy for the situation he was in. My mother finally got a job. It was 18 miles away from our house, and my father was left to take care of the children. And, of course, I was just a baby, and so he was the one that was left to take care scared me. And he was pretty abusive. No reason to go too far into that. But he got a job finally when I was 3 years old and building the parochial school, the Catholic school. And my mother was a heavy-duty, strong Catholic, so they were all excited. And when I was 3 years old, I was put in kindergarten there while he did the work, and I was taken care of by the nuns. And I had, when the nuns weren't around, I had all kinds of babysitters. My father finally got a job in a factory. He was a blue-collar worker. And basically, I was just taken from place to place. My mother was working. The kids, the other siblings were going to school and that kind of thing. And I was this kind of frightened little girl. I was pretty scared most of the time, and I started to become really sick. I had allergies. I had asthma. My parents were always mad at me because I cost so much money. They weren't really happy with me most of the time. And, you know, they had so many issues of their own. They didn't have time for one of us to be really sick. Now, my mother, being this heavy-duty religious person, she dealt with my father basically by being very over-religious and shoving, you know, religious stuff down his throat all the time. He didn't ever go to church. He basically, Saturday nights he spent, you know, normally he would leave Saturday afternoon and he would come back Saturday nights and he was out of it. You know, he was very, very drunk. He ended up on the bed. Lots of times he'd go out and the car was still running in the morning. I mean, he just, that's the way he dealt with his life. And on Sunday mornings they'd have this huge fight and they would cuss each other out. My mother would drag us all to church, and the church was in the backyard from where we lived. So my mother expected us to go to church not just every Sunday, but we had to go just about every day. And when you go to the parochial school, you pretty much go to school every day. So I had a whole lot of religion going on. My mother was very, very angry most of the time. She had always, one of us kids had to be in the doghouse. She, you know, somebody had to be the person that she was mad at the time. So usually, and all the other kids had to be mad at that person too. So it kind of pitted us kids against each other. We never really got along, and we're kind of distant to this day. We still have, we have some connections, but we're not as close as I would like to be. And my parents threatened us a lot. If we, you know, if we did anything wrong, they were going to tell us that they'd lock the doors and they wouldn't let us in. And my father, just like his father beat him, he beat my brother. And it was just, you know, a scary household for me. I was full of all kinds of anxieties and fears, and I was terrified of this man, and I just, you know, it was a tough household. And when I was about somewhere between 11 and 12 or 13 years old, I can't remember the exact age. I've tried to go back there and remember it, but my parents, my brother and sisters were older than I was. So, and everybody left home as quick as they possibly could. I had one sister, she'd run away from home. I had another sister who'd gone off to nursing school, and my brother went off to engineering school. So they were gone. And it was a summertime, and my parents wanted to go on a vacation. And they decided they weren't going to take me with them. They were going to leave me home alone. And I had a babysitting job, so I was left home for an entire week, except I was really, really scared. And when I came home from my babysitting job, it would get dark outside. And here all these years, I had, when my father got his job, he would come home at night. He worked 3:30 to midnight. This was before they went on this vacation, but he would always come home and he would just drink. The bottom part of our refrigerator was full of cases, like a case of beer was in there all the time, and you could not touch anything. If anything was messed up and he knew what it was, he would get us all out of bed and yell at us and who took my beer kind of stuff. So he would come home and drink and go to bed, you know, and I thought, well, if my dad can do that, maybe I can do that too. So here I was, this kid home all alone. My father had built this liquor cabinet. And I got in there, and he had some red velvet whiskey in there. And I cannot tell you how much I drank that night, but I slept really well that night. And not only that, but my fears were gone that night. It was, like, unbelievable. And I thought, my gosh, this is a very young kid thinking, wow, this stuff is cool. I really like this stuff. And I kind of had that moment where this is what a solution, you know, to my life. But you know, when you're 11 to 13 years old, you can't get alcohol very much. But my mother lived in a traditional, Italian family, and they celebrated everything. I mean, they celebrated weddings and funerals and Christmas and birthdays, and we had all these family reunions, and boy, was there a lot of drinking going on. And I could get sips out of the drinks. If everybody left their drinks laying around, I'd go around and I'd drink that. I had a couple of cousins, and we'd steal the alcohol. We'd go off, and we'd steal it from here and there and everywhere. So I was able to get, quite a bit, and I started really liking this stuff as I was moving on through high school and stuff. The thing was that I could function. I could drink all I wanted, or whatever at night, and I would, when I would start drinking, I really didn't know how much I was going to drink, as much as I could get, basically. But I could function very well. I could, just like my father could drink and go to work, I could drink and go to school. I was a cheerleader. I was in social clubs. I don't think anybody really had a clue of what I was really doing. So I had kind of this dual life going on. And in high school, I had a really cool girlfriend. Her parents had a lot of money, and they had this whole bar in their house. And I loved going over to her house, and I went over to her house all the time. Every time I could spend the night there, I would. And the two of us would get into that liquor cabinet, especially because her parents went out all the time, and we would mix every possible drink you could, possibly imagine. And I loved it, every single minute of it. When I graduated from high school, my father didn't want me to go to this one college I wanted to go to, and I could go to a business school, but I had to pay for it. So I got a New York State higher education loan, and I had to work during the summer in order to have enough money, just to get to college on. So I got a job in a factory. It was about 18 miles from my home, and I rode back and forth in the car with these men. I just got this ride, and they would pick me up at the end of my street, and then we would drive to work, and then they would pick me up after work, and I worked 3:30 to midnight, just like my father did, and they had booze in the car, and I drank with them, all the way home, and then my boyfriend would be waiting for me when I got home in his car, and I'd just go from their car to his car, and I would just drink, and I would come home out of it, but nobody really noticed it. My mother was in bed, my father was drinking, so it was a cool thing. It was just a way of life for me, and it's just what I did. Well, when I finally got to college, I pledged a sorority, and there was a lot of drinking going on in that sorority. Any kind of pledging, if anybody ever did anything like that, whoa, there's a whole lot of stuff going on. And there were fraternity parties and sorority parties, and I, of course, had to be involved in all of that stuff. And one night, I was at a party and had enough to drink, and this guy who had wanted to date me, I didn't want to date him, but he, every time I dated somebody, he would become their new best friend. And it really made me angry. So I got up after many drinks, and I started telling him off in this party. I mean, just telling him everything I thought about him. Every four-letter word was coming out of my mouth, apparently. And I woke up. Suddenly, I woke up the next day in my bed in the dormitory. That was my very first huge blackout. I did not know, but my roommates told me all the things I did that night, and I didn't know anything about them. The fact that you could have a blackout and you could function like that in a blackout. So that was the start of these blackouts that I would have. And my roommates were getting were pretty tired of me. Our fraternity brothers decided to have a slave auction to make money. So they offered, or they sold the sorority sisters as slaves in for a day. We would be slaves for a day. So they auctioned us up. They put us on this stage, and they auctioned us off. And for some reason, my accounting professor bought me for a day. Well, I thought I was going to have, he lived in a bachelor house with five guys, and I thought I was going to have to clean this house. And I thought I was going to have to, they had a swimming pool. I had no idea what they were going to make me clean. And he picked me up, and guess what? He wanted a drink. So we went over to the house, and we drank all afternoon, and we had the most fantastic time. We laughed. We carried on. We got in the pool. We had a wonderful time. Now, he couldn't date a student. The teachers couldn't date students, so he would send, he had these five roommates, and he would send one of them at a time to pick me up at my dormitory and take me somewhere where so I could meet him for a date. So, and usually it was a bar or something like that. So my friends couldn't believe I had all these good looking guys coming and picking me up, and I thought this was the coolest thing ever. And we just went to the bar and we just drank and I just came home. Well, we had this bar, it was called Duffy's Tavern, and I would save all of my money. I wouldn't even eat sometimes, so that I had enough money every Thursday night so we could go to Duffy's. And when I got to Duffy's, I would drink. And I probably went into quite a few blackouts there. I remember getting up on stage, singing with a band, falling through a chair, you know, that kind of stuff. It was kind of bad. Well, this professor who had been dating me, he came in one night to Duffy's and he dropped an engagement ring in my drink. And he said, look at this. And wasn't it fitting? I mean, here we are, both of us. He was drinking, I was drinking. This alcoholic's first husband, my ring was in a drink. Of course it was. So anyway, he was also Italian. My father liked him. So this was going to be a good marriage. At least I thought so. His philosophy of life was he wanted to drink, raise hell, and have a good time. And that was, if you ask him what he wanted in our life, that's all it was. And that's what we did. We drank, and we did all kinds of absolutely crazy things. He decided he wanted to leave the college, not be a professor anymore, and grow in business. So in those days, when you grew in business, you did a lot of entertaining. You took people out all the time. And that's what he wanted to do. And he, not only that, but he wanted us to go out all the time, too. Well, some of my fears had started to come back. I was drinking, but when I wasn't drinking, I was very terrified. It got to the point where no matter where we went, I would be very, very nervous. I started getting a lot of social issues, social anxiety. I was just terrified. I had to drink before we went out. I had to have a couple of drinks, and then I would continue to drink. And during this marriage, we moved from New York to New Jersey to Atlanta, back up to Buffalo, New York, and then we moved back to Atlanta. And I was turning into this basket case most of the time, just very, very nervous person. Drinking was the only thing that was helping me. And I ended up, we were at this place in Atlanta, and I don't know the name of it. It was up on Roswell Road. It was a fish place, I think it was. And we were entertaining this people that were coming into Atlanta for our company, for the company that he was working for. And mind you, I always had jobs through all this. I have no idea how I carried on which jobs I had, but I had good jobs most of the time. But anyway, we were up there, and I had had my usual as much to drink as I can remember. And I decided, for some reason, I went outside, and I decided I didn't like the way the cars were parked. And I was out there, you know, kind of trying to direct the traffic. And they took me inside, and they got him, and he was incredibly embarrassed, and they ended up taking me home. And I decided that the reason that I had all these problems was because of him. It was just a bad marriage, you know. We didn't have an emotional connection. We were always on the go, and it was his fault, so I left him. And I divorced him. And I met up with some girls in Atlanta. I got on one of those sites where you find a roommate, and I got a nice apartment with all these girls, and we had a very good time. And during that time, we were living over at Cross Creek Apartments, and we just, you know, we did a lot of drinking and a lot of crazy crazy stuff. And I met this guy who decided he was going to introduce me to some outside substances. And I know our program is about alcoholism, but believe me, the alcohol stayed right along with it. For one year, I did a whole lot of outside substances, which caused the blackouts to get a whole lot worse. I can remember drinking at the Coach and Six down on Peachtree and waking up in New Orleans. Now, I don't know how I got there, and it was when I woke up, it was kind of scary for me to have that kind of a blackout. I don't know what happened. I also remember being in Las Vegas somewhere in a station wagon. There were animals that were in the station wagon, people, and that's all I can remember, going in and out of blackouts. I got pretty scared. I started getting, I still had a job, believe it or not, and I started getting lost on the way to work. I mean, there I would be driving off to work, and I would just be, you know, I didn't know where I was sometimes for a while. And I was getting so nervous at work because I had to, you know, you didn't want to drink. You got up in the morning, you went to work, and I would start to feel this so shaky all over that I would come home at lunch and have to have a drink and to try to get through work. Well, I decided that relationship wasn't for me because I didn't want to do the outside substances anymore. I'm sure that was the problem. Certainly alcohol was not the problem. So anyway, I broke that relationship off. And I was just really afraid of everything getting out of hand. Well, one day I was working for, I was administrative assistant for a vice president of a paper company. And in those days, we had postage meters. And I don't know if you remember the postage meters, but you had to take them to the post office to get filled. So anyway, I take this heavy duty. They were pretty heavy. I took it to the post office, and I was standing in line. And this guy comes up behind me, and he says, "That looks pretty heavy. Can I carry it for you back to your car?" And I'm going, "Well, okay," you know. And he invited me to lunch the next day. Well, I had all this social anxiety, you know, about what am I going to do? I don't really want to go in restaurants. I don't really want to be around people. And this guy shows up the next day. He's got a Corvette, and he's got a basket in there. It was a picnic basket, and it had wine, and it had sandwiches. I don't know if anybody knows where Henry's Bakery is, but anyway, he had all this stuff from him. I mean, it was wonderful. And he told me he was an ex-pro ball player, and I thought, this man is perfect. You know, I just thought, wow. And we dated for 3 years. We measured where we went. He was a traveling salesman for his own company, basically, and he would end up in different cities at the end of the week. Like sometimes he'd start out on Monday and he'd end up in Florida, and I'd usually have a plane ticket delivered to me on Wednesday to fly, or we would go somewhere and we would measure how long it took to get there by how much we drank. So if he showed up with, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 six-packs, I knew we were going to Hilton Head. Or if he showed up, you know, with kind of however much alcohol he had, I knew where the trip was going. And we did a whole lot of drinking, and I was having these experiences where I would feel like my head was leaving my body. I was having some really weird experiences. We dated for 3 years. He told me that he didn't want me to work anymore, which sounded great, and that he wanted to marry me, and he could afford me just staying home. So we married in April of 1976, but by September of 1976, I became really sick, and I was pregnant. And we had never discussed children, never. I mean, what do? You drink, you have a good time. We just never discussed any of those things. And not only was I pregnant, but the doctor told me that the pregnancy had a bit of a problem, and that the one thing that I was going to have to do was go home and go to bed. And then he pointed his finger at me, and he said, "And you've got to stop drinking." And I thought, how did he know? How would he possibly know that I was drinking? I probably reeked of it, but I didn't know that I reeked of it. So I had this motherly instinct, I don't know. But I stopped drinking. I stopped. And that was in September of 1976. And I was all of a sudden stone cold sober. Now, the husband, he is my ex-husband now, he got very, very angry with me, because I was pregnant. He told me that he was going to be very, very busy building his business. He wasn't going to have time to raise a child and that I was going to have to do this. He would, you know, I could definitely, you know, get an allowance and stay in this house. It was much, much better than anything I'd ever experienced in my life growing up or anything. And he was just going to be gone all the time. And I was going to have to raise this little girl. And I had a beautiful baby girl. And she is wonderful. Isla knows who she is. She was, as I said, she was wonderful. But all of a sudden, all those issues, here I was sober. My husband had basically kind of walked away from our relationship. And all those issues from 11 years old, you know, started coming to the surface. And I became so full of anxiety and fear that I could hardly walk to the mailbox. I could hardly leave our house. And I had an awful lot of problems with that. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had put my daughter in private school, a private school where she started. And this woman in this private school, it was a Christian private school, this woman told me about a relationship with God that I could have. And it was wonderful. I became a Christian, and I became a strong Christian. And the problem was, when I got this religion, and it was a wonderful thing. I mean, it helped me a lot. But when it went through my head, as Gary often says sometimes, that I have these filters in my head. And when it came through my head, it came out of me really weird. I would beat myself up. I would beat other people up. I knew the Bible backwards and forwards. I could beat you up with scripture. I could tell you what to do. I was the most miserable Christian that anybody would want to be around. Nobody. I feel bad for the people that were around me at that time. And I just, you know, it was just something, it was the way it happened for me. And with my family, a whole lot was still going on. My father died in 1988, and at his funeral, my brother brought his girlfriend to the funeral, and his wife showed up. She was a Christian, so I prayed with her and helped get her to a plane so she could go back to where she came from, because she didn't, you know, have to deal with this. But in the meantime, our family got into a family feud, and half was on one side, half was on the other, and in the middle of it, I got disowned by my mother. All of that drove me into counseling. And the counselor told me that I was an adult child of alcoholism, and he told me that I needed Al-Anon. So that's when I came into Al-Anon, around 1989 is when I came into Al-Anon. Now, Al-Anon really, really helped me. I have to say so much about the Al-Anon program. It's a wonderful program. I learned about the family disease of alcoholism. Boy, I really needed to learn that. And how it had been passed down. I had no idea. I had no better teaching than to pick alcoholics or for husbands and to drink myself. I mean, it was just going to happen. I learned how to face the reality in my own home, what was going on. And I hadn't been facing it very well. I was mean. I was throwing religion around just like my mother did. I was angry all the time, just like my mother was. I wasn't the best of persons to be around. But I learned to detach from the sickness in my home and my family. And I learned I could recover when others in my family had decided not to. That was a big deal. I wanted everybody to recover. I wanted everybody to get help. And most of them still haven't. But you know what? I got to get help. I learned acceptance. I had to accept where I was. I didn't have to like it, but I learned how to accept it. And I learned that my family really didn't hate me. They really, you know, my father didn't hate me. My mother, you know, wasn't all that. You know, she was angry, of course she was, but she was just sick. They were just sick people trying to, you know, trying to get through their life. And I told them about Al-Anon. I told them about all these wonderful things they could do. But, of course, that only made them more angry at me. In 1997, my mother was dying. My ex-husband would only let me go either for the funeral or I could go to see her before she died. Well, my family became extremely angry with me because I went to see her before she died. I didn't make the funeral. So I wasn't told when she died. She died 2 days after I left. But I wasn't told she died. I wasn't told where she was buried or anything like that. Not only that, but I came back home and I found out that this ex-husband, who is now ex-husband, you know, he was still in all of his addictions. He was still doing everything. I found out he had his ex addiction. He was having many, many affairs. He had a permanent hotel room not far from our house. He had kept it away from me very, very well. He was just that good at it. He signed my name to a lot of financial documents. He forged my name to IRS stuff. He had me in debt that I didn't even know I had. And he had liens on me that I didn't know about. At the same time, my daughter left for California, and I was a walking basket case one more time. Someone in Al-Anon suggested, why don't you go to AA meetings? Maybe you can gain some understanding about this whole thing if you sit in AA meetings. Well, I went into the AA meetings, and I had this cutesy, quote, little Al-Anon program. I had no idea what you guys were going to teach me. I got here, and I heard what you guys were saying, and all I could say was, oh, my God, that's me. AA was telling my story. I was dragging my sponsees in from Al-Anon. They didn't want to go to AA meetings. I go, come on, did you hear that? And they would go, no, Mary, we don't really want to go to the AA meetings. Well, I couldn't stop going, and in AA, I got the strength I needed to leave this man. Not only that, but if you could see how God works in somebody's life, I didn't have a penny. I mean, I was very poor. Suddenly this uncle died that I didn't even know died and left me an inheritance. Then I got this job in a law firm, of all places. Now, I had no idea I was going to need this law firm that much. I had to get out of IRS debt. I had to get through a divorce. I had to do so many things. I mean, I didn't have to pay a penny for that. It was unbelievable how God was working. The problem was I always had the idea that I was going to get an apartment, and what I was going to do was I was going to buy a bottle of wine. All the stuff I'd heard, all this AA stuff, all this Al-Anon stuff, well, guess what? I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and I was going to get a bottle of wine. And in AA, this is what I heard. We were reading this one day in the meeting, and I nearly thought, I thought, oh, my gosh, I went out to my car, and I just sat and cried. It says a man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55. I remained bone dry for 30 years. I had brought up my daughter. It's time for me to have alcohol again. And it goes, after a successful and happy business career at 55, then he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet and slippers and a bottle, and in 2 months he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital. Meantime, then gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether, found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man in retirement, he went to pieces and was dead within 4 years. That scared me to death. My sponsor insisted I do a very serious fourth step. She was in both programs. I did the fourth step, and I remembered all this background I had, and I said, we were in her car, and I said, oh my God, I think I'm an alcoholic. And I picked up I had been attending the early morning study group as an Al-Anon for like 3 years, and at the early morning study group that next morning, I picked up a white chip, and they gave me a standing ovation. And I learned so many things in AA. There's not enough hours to tell you what I learned and continue to learn, just like you guys are doing it. I know. I had no idea what the bondage itself was. I didn't know. I didn't learn that at Al-Anon. Al-Anon was wonderful, but I didn't learn about the bondage itself. I was driven by 100 forms of fear. You bet I was. I still have the fears, but they're a lot better now. I mean, they're just in different locations, but I still have them. I have to work on them. I was here by a series of my own choices. I chose that husband. I chose what I was doing. I chose to drink. And if I chose to drink again, where was I going to end up? And I learned how much alcoholic thinking I was carrying. I mean, I was doing crazy stuff, and I was going to buy myself alcohol. After all this work I had done, I was going to buy a bottle. I work today the AA program very seriously, and I wake up. I have to remember that I wake up every single morning with the programming of that 11-year-old little girl, and I have to remember that there are tools I have to use on a daily basis to continue to keep myself in a place where I'm not going to want to have to drink. And you know, the fears, like I said, they're not necessarily gone, but they're definitely better than they used to be. And then the good things started happening in AA. My sponsor insisted I do a lot of service work, and I did a lot. And then one night, they were having a Valentine's Day dance at NABA, and I did not want to go. I was going through this divorce. I was miserable. I didn't want to go watch other people dancing and having fun. You know, I wasn't dating anybody. I figured that at my age, when I left my ex-husband when I was in my 50s, there wasn't going to be any more men in my life. I just figured that was pretty much over. Well, I got to this dance. What happened was I went to the meeting that night. My sponsor said, "You're going to the dance." And she said, "You're coming with me." And she got in front of me, and she said, "You follow me down these stairs." Well, her husband was in the program. He went behind me. The two of them go down the stairs. They pay and get my hand stamped, and they leave me there at the dance. And sweet Debbie Olmstead, or Debbie O, she was running the meeting, the dance. And I asked her if I could help out, and she said, "No, I have everything under control." I was like, "Okay, what am I going to do now?" Well, another guy that was president of NABA, Bob M., came and got me and said, "Why don't you come sit at my table?" So I went and sat with him thinking, oh, maybe we'll dance. Well, he got up, and he danced with everybody in that room but me. And I'm thinking, oh, this is single life. This is really going to be fun, you know. So I walked across the room, because another friend of mine was sitting over there, and I ran into Gary N., who's in this meeting. And we have been married now for 14 years. And the thing was that Gary introduced me to a whole new program. He was, I don't know if anybody remembers Bill Roop, but Bill Roop had many, many years in the program when he was an icon. And Bill Roop spoke all over the place, and Gary was his driver. And they took me with them. I cannot tell you how many places I've been, places that I was scared to get out of the car, because we went to some places down in Hayville and places like that where Bill Roop was going to be talking. I got to sit up front, always in the front row, because we were with Bill. I got to meet so many wonderful people. We went to conferences. We went to roundups. We flew all the way out to California to the Pacific group. I mean, so much wonderful stuff to add to my program. And if any of you are just, I was just going to stay in the early morning study group and just see where it was kind of comfy and cozy, and you know, nobody had to make any changes. I didn't want any more changes. And I needed to grow in the program. And I didn't realize how much growth is available out there in this program. So much. And Gary and I, you know, we're very fortunate that our marriage isn't perfect, but we have what we call a recovery marriage. And when one of us is in trouble, when one of us is upset, or we get into a problem, we let each other go. We let each other go and get to our sponsors. And if it doesn't matter how many meetings you want to go to, just leave and go, you know. And we understand that. I'm so grateful that we have that. And one last thing, it's getting towards the end. In 2013, I became very sick. I woke up one morning with a very high fever. And Gary, basically, I couldn't stand up. Gary carried me to the doctor. He gave me all this medicine. And I couldn't, for some reason, what I had wouldn't go away. So I kept going back and getting more medicine. And I had six rounds of antibiotics, and some of them were 14-day rounds, and I couldn't get over this problem. So they ended up sending me to a pulmonologist, and he had to give me more antibiotics. And what I didn't know was that they were tearing up my body. And I became very, very ill. I ended up having a heart procedure. I ended up very sick in bed for 18 months with two autoimmune diseases. And I was mad at God. I was so angry. I mean, here I got my husband and all, and I couldn't get out of bed. I was so angry, and I was just looking at the ceiling, cussing him out. And, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. And out of this program, a beautiful woman came out of this program who is my sponsor today, who had been through something similar. And she walked me through that. We worked on the steps. We did serious inventory work. I read page 60 through 63 every single day. And that, I'm not through with this. I still have, some of these things don't necessarily leave you, but I can handle it a lot better than I used to. I'm not crying over it. I'm not depressed. I've learned how to live my life with what I've got, you know, and it's been really good. So, I just wanted to say that, and I just want to remind everybody in this room and how I feel that I have walked into a miracle. This AA is just an absolute miracle. This is not common, what we go through. What we come into these rooms and we learn is not common. And we taking it for granted is something I never, ever want to do. And I just, you know, there are people out there that are hurting, that I don't know why they're not in here. I don't know why somehow I'm still sober. I don't know. But I'm very, very, very grateful. And, you know, I get to see every day, I get to see marriages restored. I get to see health restored. I get to see families restored. And I'm so grateful for it all. And I'm grateful for you guys tonight. And thanks, Tim, for letting me tell my story. I'm done. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for sharing the miracle with us. I'm going to unmute some folks to chime in. Ali, you're unmuted, I think.
Let me be the first. That was awesome, Mary. Thank you so very much.
Love you.
I'll bet you. I don't remember, but I'll bet I was at that Valentine's dance.
Probably
were. I was at most of them. But what a wonderful telling of your experience, strength, and hope. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Isla. Love you. Thank you.
And give my love to that beautiful daughter of yours when you see her again.
I will.
And kisses for all the dogs.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mary. I've seen you around in several meetings, and it was really nice to hear your story. And so thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I hope you're doing well. It's really good to see you.
Thanks, Tricia. It's good to see you, too.
Thank you, Mary. So nice to hear your story. I appreciate that very much. It's good to see everyone.
Yes, Mary, thank you both. I would like to also mention that in a meeting, Tim mentioned that next week is the rebuttal meeting. And I didn't know if you were aware that was said, but it's made me giggle. I've been looking forward to this all week. Thank you so much for your bravery and your candor.
Thanks, Susan.
My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic. When I was leading a meeting at, actually a Zoom meeting at noon in Loganville, and would you believe, after the meeting was over, some female that I'd never saw before knew Debbie Olmstead at NABBA and knew this story and knew that we were put together by Debbie. So the word does get around. That was a hoot.
You guys definitely, y'all both are a miracle. Hopefully we'll get Debbie on the docket in the next few months.
Yeah. That would be great.
Hey, Mary. I've probably known you almost the entire time you've been sober, and yet that's the first time I've heard your story. I could just about tell Gary's for him, but that's the first time I heard your story. That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Love you. Love you, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary, for your story. I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. We don't know each other, but I feel like I know you a lot better now, and your journey and your courage telling your journey tonight has really affected me and really helped me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. And Mary, it's always great to hear an AA story that includes Al-Anon. We've got more than a handful on the website. I've had to turn to Al-Anon, and actually I've seen you and Gary meet in Al-Anon meetings, and you two were the first two people that I really felt safer in Al-Anon. When I first came in, there's some rules about, you know, alcoholics and their sharing. They can shut you down, you know, if you're whining and crying. I tell you what, it's done me a lot of good.
It's a wonderful program. It really is. Well worth your time.
Just another homesick child. Ready to stand and try to move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, have some mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. Shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons fall apart, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of God. Keep me out of the shadow of God. from the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky, till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt? Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.